6:15. Welcome. For those of you who didn't get the two papers last night, there are two papers up here worth taking. I think one is the sort of outline for the week, and the other is a chronology of the conflict, which inevitably, since it's only two sides of a page, doesn't have everything on it. And I encourage people to look at the chronology and maybe find something that you wonder why the hell it's not on there, or why it is on there, and ask about that. I thought a way to begin tonight, or at least the way I'd like to begin, is just to hear questions that are on your mind. Because one of the problems with doing a week, and doing it sort of historically the way I'm doing it, is you may leave just at the point when we get to the part of the history that you're most interested in. And I'd like to just get a sense of what questions are on your mind, and then I'll make notes of them, and hopefully in the next, we've got three more days, I'll be able to at least respond to the questions. As I said a few minutes ago, I'm not sure I'll be able to answer them, but at least I can respond. So what questions about this conflict, about the U.S. role, about peace possibilities? I have a sense that this conflict is, public enough that many people, pay some attention to it and probably have some questions. What questions? I just want to make some notes.
I'm not sure if it's a question, but more of an understanding of how the Israelis can the property rights for the I guess it would be the West Bank, but how the Israelis can go in and take away from the Jordanians the homes that they have built and lived in all their lives, and maybe even at just a moment's notice. It sounds to me like it can be within an hour's time that they're given to move out. And I guess I don't quite get all of that.
That's fair question. Take from the Palestinians. You said Jordanian, but I'm
Palestinian. I was thinking Jordan.
Yeah, that's okay.
I don't understand the United States' role in this. I mean, when we go into Iraq, I personally feel like we have absolutely no business being there.
Right.
But in a lot of places, and I probably just don't understand the history.
Okay, and tomorrow, that's a major focus of tomorrow's session, the U.S. role. So, but obviously a big question.
I'm interested somewhat like his question about the property rights. So the property rights transitions when it was first established, the property rights transitions of the current changes, and if there is to be a partition, how those property rights will be dealt with. Someone owns property, they're on the wrong side of the line where they want to be.
Okay. Sure. Okay. Yes.
I'd like you to speak to the what the effects of the religious differences and persecution between the Muslims and the Jews, particularly, and how they...
So the effects of sort of the religious differences in the conflict.
Well, and not so much that, but, that and how the Muslims have historically not tolerated the Jews all the time. And I wonder what their feelings are now.
Okay.
Are they as severe as they used to be?
Okay. All right.
My concerns, Iran, Hezbollah, the obvious arms flow from Iran, Syria, that working down through Lebanon and all of that.
And you added Hamas, which is...
Hamas.
Yeah, which is obviously in Gaza.
Right.
Yeah. But the Iranian connection to...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Big
what
issue.
Do you do about it?
Yeah. Yes.
The status and the attitudes of the Palestinian Christians. We haven't heard about them, but yet.
Yeah. Status and attitudes, yeah.
Here.
Yep.
Well, I'd like to know just what you and Carol do and how you do it. I mean, it's an amazing job that you have, and just how you do what you do and how you get called into it, and what do you do as they sit at the table?
I'll leave Carol off the hook. She's a Lutheran pastor at St. John United Lutheran Church.
You often say Carol and I.
Well, Carol and I, we had this job together for the Quakers in the Middle East for 3 years, 82 to 85. But when we came back, we had decided we're probably not going to do a coordinated job like that again. I don't have a sense of Paul and Carol here making that same decision, but maybe, you sort of learn as you go. But I think we did well, and our differences were very helpful to the quality of listening we did, because we listened differently. Not no big surprise. Anyway, but since we're back, Carol went to seminary, became a Lutheran pastor. I wrote a book on the Middle East, and I've been working on this issue since 85, since we returned. So now it's what I can answer, what I do.
Okay.
Yes.
What do you do?
Yep, go ahead.
Oh, the influence of the U.S. Jewish community on our governmental policies.
Great, great. Yeah. That will also come out some tomorrow night, but it's a big question. Yeah.
I have heard that there have been some golden time periods where Muslims, Jews, Christians have gotten along very well in community, and I just wonder if there are people that look at those times and say, how can we make that work today?
Yeah, good. Yeah. I'll make a reference to that tonight. That's a huge subject. I mean, it's really a subject of Muslim, Jewish, Christian relations over the centuries, not just in the context of, say, the last 100 years. And it's a big subject. The story is a complex one. But I will make at least one reference to it tonight as I'm talking about this subject tonight. Who else? Yes?
Well, we're leaving tomorrow, unfortunately. And I don't know if you want to give anything away, but I'm really interested in knowing what you think could possibly work there.
What could work? What peace would look like, or what?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. Lots of good.
Sure. Well, let me just say, for any of you who are leaving, one document that I have that I was going to pass out, I think day after tomorrow, is a summary of the Geneva Accord, which you, Leah, I know you know about it, but I would encourage people, if you're leaving tomorrow or the next day and are not going to be able to come see me, and I'll give you a copy of that. There's also a website you can go to. But the Geneva Accord, just very briefly, is an unofficial peace treaty written by very prominent Israelis and Palestinians, many of whom participated in the official negotiations, and when they ended, they just kept talking. And the Swiss government made a grant for them to come to Switzerland over a couple of years, and they have written a detailed peace treaty, which in the initial couple of years after it came out in 2003, polls showed that majorities of Palestinians and of Israelis said they probably could accept ideas along these lines. They didn't use the word Geneva Accord because Geneva Accord gets associated with the characters who wrote it, that is the political figures who wrote it, and those persons are controversial among various, they're viewed very differently. It's sort of like if Al Gore says something on the environment, you might say, well, what he's saying on the environment is right, but I don't like Al Gore, Who doesn't like Al Gore? anyone else have a question that you hope we attend to? All right, great. I'm going to keep that sheet. And then the other sheet that is on this pad, which I'll just pass around. I work this is part of the answer to your question. I work as the staff for the heads of 25 to 30, depending on how big good the consensus is when we issue a statement, 25 to 30 heads of Jewish, Christian, and Muslim American religious organizations. So including Mark Hansen. Mark is one of the leaders of that initiative. I'm the staff person, so it means I draft statements that then are sent out to them, and usually there are some changes made in the statements, and we work on the basis of consensus. We've been in business together, business isn't the word for it, we've been working together since 2003. We've met a number of times at very high levels of the government, not with the president, but with secretaries of state. We're looking forward to a meeting with Secretary of State Clinton sometime this fall. We also send letters to the Congress, usually when we issue a statement. And just to say, that's the organization. Its acronym is NILI, N-I-L-I. And if you want to get occasional news, and given the fact that it's composed of national leaders, it is only occasionally. I mean, this is not their job, So it's only every couple of months that they would issue a statement or something. But if you want to get those statements from me on an email basis, just put your name and your city and email on this paper and just pass it along.
City also.
Well, I say city partly because I travel a lot in the United States to speak at churches and synagogues, and I welcome opportunities to come wherever you are and meet with people. So this evening, we're going to start with this concept where we left off yesterday. The concept of I'll use the phrase, bone-deep connections that both Jews and Palestinians feel to the same small land. And I use the phrase bone deep to suggest that their connections to the land that they feel are not ideas. They're not ideas, they're not concepts. They are something that feels like it's in their blood and in their bones. And as illustration of that, frequently when people meet with Palestinians, and I remember a particular meeting with Palestinian women, where the women brought out keys. This was in the West Bank, but the women brought out keys to their family homes that were along the coast in what's now Israel. And they had the keys. And they waved the keys at us and said, these are still our homes, and we want to go back to our homes. And we will never accept that we should not be able to go back to our homes. And then a story about a Jewish man that I got to know quite well, who happened to be, for many years, the head of Israeli military intelligence. And as the Arab views changed about the conflict, his views changed, and he became a strong advocate of negotiating with the PLO and accepting a Palestinian state. He tells me the story of his father, who came to the land from Eastern Europe in the early part of the 20th century. And when he got there, he was so moved by being back on the land that he took off his shoes and for the rest of his life almost never wore a pair of shoes, because his feet felt so connected to the land. I say that to say that in listening to people on both sides of this conflict, Carol and I came to accept the reality that both Jews and Palestinians feel deeply connected to this land, and whatever solution there's going to be has to take account of that, because those connections are not going to dissolve. They're not going to dissolve. And people will fight for them, people will resist for them, people will do awful things for them, but people also might be willing to do good things to make those connections work. So I start there, and I remind us, for those of us who were here yesterday, that that sort of bone-deep connection which both Jews and Palestinians feel to the same small land led to a situation in the conflict for, I would say, most of 40 years, from shortly after Israel was created until the late 80s, where each side wanted the other to disappear. And that's not typical of most conflicts. Most conflicts are more or less this or that. More or less rights for one group, more or less rights for another. More or less this, you know, in other words, there's some room for negotiating compromise. But this is a conflict where each side wanted the other to disappear. And to put it clearly, Palestinians, the PLO, the Arab states, wanted Israel gone. They came to accept that there probably were going to be a lot of Jews there, but there shouldn't be an Israel. There shouldn't be a Jewish state there. They felt it was a gross injustice. And they took positions, had policies, went to war to try to accomplish getting rid of Israel. On the Israeli side, the Israelis never wanted to get rid of all the Arab countries. It's a bit ridiculous. But they did want to get rid, not get rid of the Palestinians, but get rid of the Palestinian insistence that this was their land. They wanted that to disappear. They were willing to have Palestinians stay on, but they should shut up. I mean, basically. They should live quietly and stop making demands that they should have a stay here. And that's a pretty difficult conflict to resolve. And it was that way up through the 80s. In the 60s, one of the changes that took place, one of the changes in place, you can make a note of this, that 1964 was the formation of the PLO, Palestine Liberation Organization. And that's significant because up until then, the Palestinian National Movement was more amorphous. But when the PLO was formed, that was the organization that had a structure, had leadership, that represented Palestinian insistence on their right to a state all in this same area, including where Israel had come exist in 48. The thing I started to stop to say that I want to say now is, for many years this conflict, if you look back in magazine, what do they call, Periodical Guide to Literature, and you look at magazine articles up until about the early 80s, you'll see this conflict referred to mainly as the Arab-Israeli conflict. Beginning in the 80s, particularly with the war in Lebanon, and then even more so with the Palestinian uprising in 1987, it began to be referred by many as the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And just think with me for a moment about the difference in perception. If it's viewed as the Arab-Israeli conflict, which is the big guy, which is the small guy? Simple, right? If it's viewed as the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which is the big guy, which is the small guy? And so you can imagine that just the different terms, both they evoke different emotions, they evoke different images of what the conflict is. I have, for some years, insisted on referring to it, and this initiative, the interreligious initiative refers to it, and I think appropriately, as the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Because that brings in the elements that need to be involved in a solution. In 1967, there was the third Arab-Israeli war. I said yesterday, that it's a war in which I think you can argue for a long time who started it, both sides. I would suggest both sides did. Israel fired the first shot. And for the war only lasted 6 days. For the first three, Israelis and Jews around the world were very nervous. They thought Israel was going to lose. And that meant the end of Israel. But Israel won in 6 days. And when they won, they took the following territories, and they captured the following territories. The Golan Heights from Syria, the Gaza from Egypt, and Gaza and the Sinai. They captured all of the Sinai in the 67 war, and they captured the West Bank and Jerusalem from Jordan. That was very significant. In a way, and we'll get back to this when we get to possible solutions, in a way, that war set up the framework for a possible solution, because now, as you know, when they talk about a Palestinian state, they're talking about a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza, two of the territories that Israel captured in the 67 war. As a result of that war, which was the second major war that Israel won decisively, the first was 48, the second was 67, as a result of that, some Arab leaders began, mostly privately, to acknowledge that they weren't going to get rid of Israel. And the conflict and Israelis less so, but Israelis began to sense that probably negotiations were going to be the way this thing might be resolved. One evidence on the Arab side that came out at the time of Oslo is that apparently Nasser, who was then the president of Egypt, called the PLO leadership to Cairo secretly and said to them, the game is over. We are not going to defeat Israel militarily. You've got to find some political way to get your demands met. That was not publicized. The PLO never said it publicly. And publicly, the Arab leaders were saying much of the same things they've been saying all along. We're going to get rid of Israel. No, we won't negotiate. We won't make peace with Israel. But quietly, that war was part of a turning point from a certain Arab vision of defeat of Israel to an Arab acceptance that probably Israel was here to stay. 19, the vision of a different way to solve the conflict didn't work its way toward policy sufficiently, so that in 1973 there was another war. This one called the Yom Kippur War. It was a war in which, in this case, Egypt and Syria struck first at Israel, and they struck during Yom Kippur. It's sort of like being attacked during Christmas holidays here. You know, I mean, in other words, in the sense that people are not focused on defending the country at Christmas. And Jews were not focused on defending the country. And there was a whole scandal that came out afterward about military unreadiness and da-da-da-da because they were attacked on Yom Kippur. That war ended more or less indecisively, except for all the people who were killed in it. Kissinger negotiated the sort of final armistice agreements, but borders did not change much in that war. There were some changes and temporary changes. For instance, Israel actually crossed out of the Sinai, across the Suez Canal, but then the Egyptians drove them back. And And at a high level, and this is one of the things that should have made us all nervous when this was going on, both in this war and in the 67 war, both the Soviet Union and the United States were on the highest level nuclear alerts. Planes were in the air. Depending on developments on the ground there, it conceivably could have led to nuclear war between the Soviet Union and the United States. Soviet Union supporting the Arab side, the U.S. supporting the Israeli side. So, and that's an element which, you know, many people didn't pay attention to, but just think about what that could have meant. I mean, that's the level of importance that both the Soviet Union and the United States gave to this issue. As a result of that war, the 73 war, after Nasser died, Sadat became president. Sadat began to explore possibilities for negotiations. And if you may remember, in 1977, President Sadat of Egypt offered to come to Jerusalem, to go to Jerusalem, and speak to the Israeli Knesset and begin negotiations for peace with Israel. All of the Arab countries and the PLO denounced him. Some broke relations with him, wouldn't have anything to do with Egypt. But Egypt is the biggest, most powerful country in the Arab world, and I remember talking with the Egyptian foreign minister in, I guess, late 82, and we said to him, well, you know, there must be some problems for Egypt in doing this when all the Arab world is in it. He said, sort of drew himself up in a kind of pharaonic way, you know, and said, you mark my words, we will not run after the Arabs will run after Egypt. You know, to some extent he was right, to some extent he was puffed up Egyptian. But anyway, Egypt offered to negotiate. Begin, who was then the prime minister of Israel, agreed to negotiate, although there was a moment when it wasn't clear how Begin was going to respond. And one of the things that happened in that moment was the founding of the Israeli peace movement called Shalom Akshav, or Peace Now. And interestingly, it was founded by reserve Israeli military officers. Interesting, because obviously that's not typically how we think of peace movements here in the United States. In some ways, we think of peace movements as being anti-military. But here was a case where it was reserve military officers that formed it. And they formed it because they were nervous about Begin's response. And wrote a letter to Begin urging him to respond positively to Sadat's offer. Sadat, the offer was responded positively. Sadat came. One of the interesting things, and this is a hopeful thing, I think, and in some ways characteristic of Israeli popular sentiment and changeability. When Sadat came, a week before Sadat made this announcement, if you asked any Israeli, do you think the conflict's going to be resolved with Egypt or the Arab world? Most Israelis would say, oh, are you kidding? No, they're against us forever. They want to drive us into the sea, et cetera, et cetera. After Sadat's announcement, and particularly after he came to Jerusalem, many Israelis were cheering. In fact, when Sadat came to the Knesset in Jerusalem, Israelis were out on the street applauding and waving Egyptian and Israeli flags. And I say that to say that the Israeli populace is a malleable populace. It's a volatile, in that sense, volatile populace. It can change views fairly quickly depending on circumstances. And this was a fantastic example where many Israelis came out in the streets. Well, they began to negotiate. You may know, negotiations didn't go well at all. Once they began to talk about real issues like Israel getting out of all of Sinai, giving up the oil resources, and Egypt formally recognizing Israel and having an ambassador and doing the things that you do diplomatically if you recognize another country. Once they got into some of the details or the main issues, the negotiations almost broke down, and that's where Carter comes in. And Carter invites the two parties to Camp David and plays a major role behind the scenes and at Camp David in helping the parties to negotiate toward a two-state solution. I told the story to someone at lunch that one of the things that happened in those negotiations was that the way they worked was that Egyptian and Israeli negotiators negotiated during the day face-to-face. American diplomats sat in the back and side of the room taking notes. When the Egyptians and Israelis went to bed, the Americans met, oftentimes into the early morning, figuring out what to suggest as the topics for the next day. It's an interesting model of mediation in a conflict. And sometimes you can imagine, even in labor management negotiations, that kind of thing happens, that the mediator watches, listens, and then comes the next day and says, I think we ought to focus here. And so that's part of the story of Camp David. I think the other important part of the story is that Carter decided this was a priority for him, and frankly, I think it was partly religious for him as a Baptist, that making peace in the Holy Land was a kind of faith-mandated project. So that's that leads then to the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty, the first peace treaty in the Middle East, and a peace treaty which has held despite all kinds of troubles, ups and downs, and new wars in the Middle East. It's not like floweringly positive. It's not Canadian-U.S. relations. But it isn't war. And that's very important because Egypt is the most powerful military and the biggest country in the region. So the fact that that agreement has held for all these years is very significant and suggests that both Egypt and Israel see that agreement as in their basic national interest. And so they try not to do things that would bust it apart. We're still talking now only about Egypt, and now the Sinai has gone back to Egypt, part of Egypt, including the oil resources. Interestingly, Egypt didn't want Gaza back. Gaza is inhabited by more than 1 million Palestinians, very poor, basically refugee population, plus some people who lived there before the 48 war. Egypt wouldn't take Gaza back, so Israel wound up still being in Gaza, and of course in the West Bank because Jordan hadn't made peace, still in the Golan Heights because Syria hadn't made peace. But we're still talking about Egypt and Israel so far. As I said, in other parties, both in the PLO and in these other Arab countries, discussions were going on. And Carol and I happened to live in the region during this period, 1982 to 85. So just when the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty occurred, we happened to be meeting with Syrians, meeting with Palestinians, and we were sort of privileged to be there meeting with people when they were changing their minds. Literally changing their minds and changing the politics of this conflict from a conflict where they wanted the other side to disappear to a conflict which I describe as a conflict where each side came grudgingly to accept that the other side was here to stay. And that it would have to be a negotiated resolution to the conflict. And that's a big shift, because it makes negotiation possible. And I can give you anecdote after anecdote of people changing their minds, some of them sort of funny in a way, I think funny. I went to see the deputy foreign minister of Israel in 1984, must have been 84 or even beginning of 85. It was a man by the name of Yehuda Ben Meir. Conservative guy, part of the National Religious Party, and he was the deputy to Yitzhak Shamir, who was the foreign minister, and even more hawkish. Yehuda Ben Meir's secretary didn't think Yehuda Ben Meir would want to meet with the Quakers. It turned out that part of the reason he would meet with the Quakers was because he had family in Europe who were helped by Quakers when they were refugees. And so that was sort of the opening of the conversation. And then he said, "Do you have a card?" And I took a card out of my pocket, and I handed it to him. And he took it, and he looked at it, and he said, "I don't think this is your card." And he looked angry. And I took it back, and on the card it said, "Mohammed Milhelm, Executive Committee of the PLO. So obviously, I had met with Milhelm and took his card and put it in the same pocket. And Yehuda Ben Meir looked, he said, and I said, "Oh no, I'm sorry." I said, "That's not my card." And I put it back in my pocket and gave him my card. Mm-hmm. And he took that. And I said, he said, "Do you meet with the PLO?" And I said, "Yes, we do." And he said, "You know our position on the PLO." And I said, "Well, I think so, but why don't you tell me?" And, "They're a terrorist organization. We will never meet with them. There will never be peace with the PLO. There won't be a Palestinian state," et cetera, et cetera. He stopped. I said, "I understand." And then he leaned over and quietly said, "What is the PLO saying about negotiation?" So, you know, these people were changing their mind. Nabil Shah, who later became the foreign minister of the PLO and was a PLO figure leader, we met in Cairo first, where he was living, before the Oslo happened and the PLO leaders were able to come back into Gaza and the West Bank. Nabil tells us one day when we were seeing him in Cairo, he said, "You know," he said, "growing up Palestinian, he grew up in Safed, which is up near the Mount of Beatitudes. That's where he was born." He's now living in Cairo because he was in exile since 48 and so forth. He said, you know, from an early time as a Palestinian, for years and years, I thought of the Israelis and the Jews as colonial settlers, just like other European powers. He said, but the more I got to know Jews, including Israeli Jews, and the way I got to know them was either by traveling to some neutral country where they would meet on the side of a conference or a secret meeting at Harvard or somewhere where they're doing some of this Track 2 stuff, or by telephone, once there was a peace treaty between Egypt and Israel, they talked by telephone. He said, as I got to know more and more Jews, I came to understand that their connection to this land is just as deep and sincere as ours. And then he said, I thought, a wonderful thing he said, and then I thought to myself, if the Jews are colonializers, they have the oddest history of any colonializers I know. I mean, just think of Jewish history. Does it look like the history of the British Empire? So here was this PLO guy, you know, and this Israeli official who were coming to a different position. And those are individuals, but the groups that they were a part of, the governments they were a part of, the parties they were a part of, were beginning, as I said, or were moving toward what I call, and I think not unfairly, a grudging acceptance that the other side is here to stay. In 1988, you know that the U.S. wouldn't meet with the PLO. Israel wouldn't meet with the PLO. The U.S. wouldn't meet with the PLO. And one of the experiences we had as we traveled in the region is meeting with U.S. embassy officials, which we did regularly, is many ambassadors would say to us, of course, off the record, that the U.S. is going to have to meet with the PLO. And eventually Israel is going to have to negotiate with the PLO. In other words, the ambassadors recognized that the PLO was the representative group of the Palestinians, and if you're going to make peace, you got to make peace with a group that can speak for the people. But they couldn't say that publicly. You remember there was a little bit of a thing with Andy Young. Andy Young was an ambassador of the United Nations. At some sort of reception or something, he shook hands with a PLO representative and was out. He was out as our ambassador to the UN because he did that. So we wouldn't talk with the PLO. In 1988, and remember, this is 40 years after 48. 40 years later, the PLO made a declaration that they were prepared to negotiate with Israel on the basis of the partition plan, that would be one basis, and on the basis of Resolution 242, which was adopted by the United Nations Security Council at the end of the 67 war. And I want to pass that resolution around. Now, I think I don't have enough copies to go all the way, so if you share it, however you can do that. This resolution was adopted by the Security Council at the end of the 67 war. And you'll see in a minute why it's important and why it's a reflection of this same, what I was talking about in terms of, you know, I'm going to have to take one back. Take one back? Just one. Okay, good. You can see, we've got them as far around as we can go. This is a UN Security Council resolution. It was adopted unanimously with U.S. support. There was considerable negotiation that went into its language. The U.S. was involved in that negotiation, clearly. It talks about a continuing concern for the grave situation in the Middle East. It emphasizes the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by war. In other words, you may capture territory in a war, but you cannot take it. You can't keep it. The inadmissibility of acquiring the territory. You capture territory, but then somehow they gotta go back. To work for a just and lasting peace in which every state in the area can live in security. You know, the UN, since 48, had recognized Israel. The Arab states, none of them had recognized Israel. And in fact, imagine how this feels if you're Israeli or if you're Jewish, no matter Israeli or not, that if you know in Arab countries that in the schools, all the maps don't have Israel on them. I mean, think of the sort of the indignity of that for anyone's country, then think of the special indignity of that for Jews. Israel is not there. It doesn't exist. So in this resolution, there are two, well, I'll read it. Affirms that the fulfillment of the charter principles requires the establishment of a just and lasting peace in the Middle East, which should include the application of both of the following principles. And I emphasize that because in much that goes on about this conflict today and for a number of years, sometimes one side or the other only emphasizes one of these principles. All right, the first principle, withdrawal of Israeli armed forces from territories occupied in the recent conflict. What does that mean? It means getting out of Egypt. It means getting out of Gaza, the West Bank, and out of the Golan Heights. And the second principle, termination of all claims or states of belligerency and respect for and acknowledgement of the sovereignty, territorial integrity, and political independence of every state in the area and their right to live in peace with secure and recognized boundaries from the threats or acts of force. That's a lot of words to say that the countries involved in this conflict have to recognize each other's existence, accept it, and threaten each other no more. So that this is where the phrase land for peace comes from in this conflict. That Israel returns the lands it captured in exchange for peace from the Arab states. And I'll just say again that today, and no, I think I understand, look, if you make a trip out there to Israel and the West Bank, and you see what Palestinians are going through in the occupied West Bank, say, or in Gaza, which isn't occupied anymore, but still is controlled by Israel, and you see what they're going through, it's natural to come back and say, we've got, somehow the occupation must end. But what the UN Security Council is saying is that the way the occupation must end is in exchange for recognition and security arrangements with all the states in the area. Now that seems to me to be both a moral and politically practical two-part resolution. But as I say, on the Israeli side, sometimes what you will hear is, the only thing that, there could be peace if only the Arabs would stop the violence, if only the Palestinians would stop the terrorism, then there could be peace. On the Palestinian side, if only the occupation would end, there could be peace. It'd be simple. Occupation over, peace comes. And what I'm saying is I think that the UN Security Council in this case got it right, that both have to happen, and in any case, that's what the Security Council is saying. This resolution was accepted by all of the parties, except the PLO, partly because there's no reference to Palestinian right, national rights in the resolution. A second version of the resolution in 73 made more of a reference to Palestinian rights, and finally, the Palestinians did accept it, I said, in 1988. But much earlier than that, in the late 60s, early 70s, all the countries here and Israel accepted the resolution, and when Sadat went to Israel and offered to negotiate, the basis of the negotiation was precisely this resolution. Precisely this resolution. In 1994, when Jordan and Israel agreed to negotiate peace, this resolution was the basis. So it's a very important resolution to be aware of. It's a hard one to keep focused on when people on either side, supporters on either side, get very emotional about the thing that bothers them most, either the occupation or continued violence against Israelis. And I say the occupation obviously is violence against Palestinians. I don't mean to say there's not violence, it's Palestinian. All right, so that's resolution 242 and its importance. And the PLO made a declaration in 88 saying, we're ready to negotiate this, essentially the same basis that Egypt did, based on these conditions. Arafat, say a word about Arafat here because his name came up in the first day. Arafat, for several years, had been moving in this direction. Slowly, yes, but moving in this direction. And one of the clear evidences of his moving in this direction was that the PLO organization has a central council. It has a governing council that's huge that meets every couple of years. It has a central council that has an executive committee. Arafat had been bringing in to the central leadership groups several, more and more, Palestinian leaders who supported the idea of a two-state solution. and replacing some of the other Palestinians on these executive committees in the Central Council who were opposed to the idea of negotiating with Israel. So that's one evidence that Arafat himself was moving in this direction, and Carol and I knew several of the people, including a university president, Palestinian university president, who's a graduate, by the way, of Purdue, and was president of Bir Zeit University in the West Bank, two of the mayors. He brought, including Milham, the one whose card I mistakenly gave to Ben Meir. He was bringing them into the executive committee, shoring up the support in the executive committee for the idea of negotiating with Israel for a two-state solution. Not trying to make a saint of Arafat, but I think it was one of the positive things he did and some evidence that he was moving in a direction that could lead to peace. So 1988. If you remember, in 1990, what happens that diverts attention a little bit is that Saddam Hussein invades Kuwait. I was teaching a course like this at the Chautauqua Institution in New York. I came to the course. It was started at 10 a.m. in the morning. I came to the course. There was a man sitting there already, like 10 minutes early, and he seemed very agitated. I said, do you want to have? He said, yes. He said, what do you think about Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait? I said, oh, I didn't know about it. I hadn't read the paper, you know. I hadn't seen the paper that morning. It's just that. A huge diversion, to say the least, because then there's a war. I mean, the U.S. organized a coalition to repel Saddam Hussein's forces from Kuwait. As part of building that coalition, which, by the way, interestingly, included Syrian forces, who had never fought on the side of U.S. forces before, as part of building that coalition, President Bush and Secretary of State Baker promised the Arab countries that following the war, they would make a real effort for peace between Israel and the Arab countries and the Palestinians. And indeed, after the war, they did. They worked diligently, I think creatively, but also with tremendous determination, and brought together something called the Madrid Peace Conference in 1991. It was the first time that all of the parties sat down at tables across from one another. The choice of Madrid related to the question about Muslims and Jews and Christians and the golden years, because Madrid was the center in the 12th, 13th, and 14th, and part of the 15th century, up until the late part of the 15th century, of tremendous scholarly, religious, etc., cooperation among scholars of Islam and Judaism and Christianity. There was a tremendous working together. These are golden years in terms of cooperation among the three faith traditions. So Madrid was chosen as the place for the conference as a symbol of that kind of cooperation being possible. The conference took place. As I say, all the parties were there. Interestingly, Israel was still not ready to meet directly with the PLO, so there was a little bit of a shell game where the Palestinian participants named by the PLO, but were part of a Jordanian-Palestinian delegation. That made it possible for the Israeli government to say, we're not really meeting with the PLO, we're meeting. Although it became quite clear that not only were the Palestinians chosen by the PLO, but that any positions they took in the negotiation were positions that were given to them by the PLO. Any kind of negotiating position. So this happens in 1991. It begins, one of the things that was very exciting about it, and to their credit, I mean, again, here, this is George H. Bush Sr. and Baker. They came up with an idea that in addition to the direct negotiations, they organized what were called multilateral negotiations involving many other countries in which discussion was of issues that were really not just Arab-Israeli, but region-wide, such as water, such as economic cooperation, such as security issues, such as refugee issues. So they created a second ring of negotiations. It was quite creative. The problem was that the core negotiations quickly began to bog down. Like the Egyptian-Israeli negotiations, when they started to talk, it wasn't going well. And it slowed down to almost nothing. Nothing was happening. They would just sort of come to the table and bark at each other. And that was the period when Oslo, when the government of Norway decided to offer secretly to host talks between Israel and the PLO in Norway. I often think that one time I was speaking in Pennsylvania to a group of German Lutherans, and I said something like, you know, at this point in the talk, usually Lutherans get excited, except the Germans didn't relate to it at all. It's only the Norwegians, you know, Maybe the dance in the streets, they get all excited and say, ah, well, our guys are doing it, you know? But it was extraordinary. And why Norway? Two reasons. Norway was held in high regard by Israel and by Jews because of Norway's very creative and determined resistance to the Nazis. Norway was held in high regard by the Palestinians, and John talked about this morning when he talked about Norway and foreign aid, because Norway gives a very large percentage, compared to the U.S., a percentage of foreign aid to countries in the third world, including the Palestinians. So the Palestinians also had a high regard for Norway, and Norway hosting these talks was very positive. The talks were authorized by Arafat and by Yitzhak Rabin, then the Prime Minister of Israel. And they were held in a farmhouse outside of Oslo. I would encourage you to read a book called The Process by Uri Sevier, which tells the political and the human story of those negotiations. And it's quite a moving story, but it doesn't start with moving. What it starts with is not moving. That is, when the two chief negotiators come into the room for their first dinner together, just like Clinton had to push Rabin and Arafat to shake hands, the Norwegian foreign minister practically had to push them, and did, to shake hands with each other and said, I think you want to meet each other. And they did, and of course they didn't want to meet, but they did. And then, of course, they start a process of talking with their teams, and eventually leads to the Oslo Peace Agreement. Where I want to end this evening is just to say that I think hopefully the story I've told, first of all, is relatively accurate, but that even when they got to negotiations, one of the lessons learned was that getting the parties to the table wasn't sufficient. Because unless things were happening on the ground fairly quickly and consistently, that, number one, was making the occupation less for Palestinians and making security more for the Israelis, ordinary people were hearing about these negotiations but saying, my life is not changing, and maybe in some ways has gotten worse. I mean, there are certain circumstances that might happen that would make it even seem worse. The United States, and you know that while the Norwegians did the negotiations, when it came to signing the agreement, where did they have it?
In the U.S.
At the White House. And one of the ways I describe that is that it might be possible for a butterfly to help them get to the peace agreement. But when they want to sign the peace agreement, they want to be on the lawn of the elephant. They want to be on the lawn of the most powerful country in the world, and the one that, while its relations with Palestinians are not as warm as with Israel, clearly has positive relationships with Israel and is firmly and can make this, can put power behind this agreement. And so it's signed on the White House lawn. I was privileged to be among those there. And just one more thing about that agreement, when it was signed, when Arafat, and there were probably 2,000 people there, and most of the people were people who had worked on this issue in one way or another for many years, when Arafat and Rabin shook hands, I remember my own sound response. It was, and all 2,000 people gasped. They gasped. And it was almost as if it was scripted in the ceremony. A kind of an amen or hallelujah, but it wasn't even that. It was more just, you know, like, did I ever believe I'd see this? And I think that's important to realize, because these two men, Rabin, who had led the wars against the Arab countries, who had, in the first Palestinian uprising, had been the person who had given voice to this idea, we will break their bones, to the Palestinians who were resisting the occupation. And Arafat, who had been the leader of the PLO, had been in some ways responsible for the terrorist actions that various factions of the PLO, including his own, had done against Israel. Here were these two men shaking hands. We're going to look tomorrow mainly at the U.S. role. And I'll just give you a clue of my view. I think I say in the outline, U.S. policy, part of the problem or part of the solution? My answer is both. You remember Eldridge Cleaver,
Anybody remember Cleaver? Cleaver said about racism, he said, you're either part of the problem or you're part of the solution. Right? So it was real clear, and I remember thinking that at the time. In fact, I think I wore a Cleaver button that said that. You're part of the problem or part of the solution. And I appreciate that kind of clarity, but I think this is a case, in fact, where Cleaver's thing has to be turned on its head, and the fact is that the United States has been and is both part of the problem and an essential part of the solution. So we'll talk more about that tomorrow. It's 7:05. We probably have a few more minutes, but Vespers is at 7:30. So a few questions or on things I've said or didn't. Yep.
Someone asked about Christians in Israel.
Oh, yeah. Christian Palestinian.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
The last time I was in Israel, which was 2005.
Yeah.
I had an Arab Christian cab driver.
Oh, yeah.
Who had spent some time in Iowa in a print shop. He was a young guy. He had three little kids, and he said, his grandfather had come from Europe, actually, but he was an Arab, to settle in Israel, the Holy Land, but he was planning to move his family out. He was trying to get back to the States because he said his children were so tortured by Muslim children that they were picked on and bullied and because they were Christians. And he just said, I don't want to raise my children this way. So I think they are a very small minority, mm-hmm. but they do have a lot of problems.
Well, and we're talking here about two groups of Palestinian Arab Christians. One would be Palestinian Arab Christians who are among those Arabs or Palestinians who are Israeli citizens. That is to say, in 1948, Palestinians who remained inside Israel were granted Israeli citizenship. A lesser version of it. I mean, there were many ways in which they were treated as second class citizens, including, of course, not being allowed in the army, which then gives you certain privileges in terms of social welfare benefits and so forth. But so some of those Palestinians who remained and became Israeli citizens, a small percentage, probably not more than 5% or so, are Christians. Then we're also talking about Palestinians who live in the West Bank and in Gaza, again, where there's a small percentage who are Christian, and it is a declining percentage. It is a declining percentage, and it is of grave concern to Palestinians, and I think probably also to most churches in the United States who are aware of this, that Palestinian Christian minority is declining as a percentage of the population. And the main reason it's declining is because Palestinian Christians find it more easier to emigrate to the West than Palestinian Muslims. Partly because they're Christian, but also partly because generally Palestinian Christians have higher education levels, are more urban in the West Bank, and have more economic skills, more job ready. I think the business of Muslim tensions, Palestinian Muslim tensions with Palestinian Christians, Leah, I think is blown up some. I mean, exaggerated some. I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but the Israeli government has had a very conscious policy of saying that Christians are leaving because of Muslim pressures. And from all my experience, they're leaving because the pressure of the conflict, which, almost you can understand why anybody would want to get out, and because it's easier for them to go.
But he told me.
No, I'm not saying there's no problem. I'm saying it is, when the answer is that's what the situation is, I think it's much exaggerated. And Palestinian Christians, I mean, I just was out there in December, and we met with Palestinian Christian leadership of various stripes, I mean, Greek Orthodox, Catholics, Lutherans, and that was, in fact, they argued that don't say that this is the issue. The issue is the lack of peace, and the occupation. Sure, there are tensions. I mean, for instance, just recently, Palestinian Christians issued a document called Kairos.
And part of you, you have to read that document, partly their sensitivity about the strength of Hamas. And they're trying to say things that don't make them look to Hamas people as if they are so much for peace that they sound like they're pro-Israeli, which they're not going to sound anyway. But they're conscious of that. And obviously, I think Hamas has a vision of a society, creating a society that many Christians would be quite uncomfortable with. Yep.
Since the signing there on the White House grounds there with the visible gas, there's lots of things that's gone on. You know,
yes.
With the wall and the settlements and so many other things. Are you more hopeful, less hopeful, conflicted? Where are you personally? Because you've dealt with all of it. I'm curious.
I think the short answer to that is that hopes raised, which they were when the Oslo Agreement was signed, hopes raised and then dashed are worse than no hopes in the first place. People's expectations for a peace agreement, both among Israelis and Palestinians, rose tremendously with the signing of Oslo. And by the way, many things happened in the 90s. Some of them were bad, but some of them were good. There were various kinds of cooperative efforts that developed, various kinds of exchanges, youth groups meeting, Palestinian and Israeli. The Jordanian, Israeli, and Palestinian education ministries had a project to examine all the textbooks to see how they had to be changed in light of the coming peace agreement. Palestinian jazz Jewish jazz musicians from Tel Aviv sat in at Palestinian jazz clubs in Ramallah. There were environmental groups started that were Jordanian, Palestinian, Israeli. So there were a lot of things happened during the 90s that were a result of people's hopes and expectations. When the summit was held that Clinton hosted in 2000 and it failed to reach agreement, it was a devastating blow to people's hopes. But people's hopes had already been seriously injured by developments by the negative developments in the 90s. And I'll just cite two. One, increased expansion of settlements and settlements roads. These blue dots up here are my version of where the settlements are in the West Bank. And then these roads that connect them that are only to be used by people with certain color license plate, which means either Israeli or if you happen to be Palestinian and live in Jerusalem, you may have that color license plate. That's one thing. The expansion of settlements has been devastating to Palestinian hopes for a real state. The other thing that's been devastating is violence. And with the growth of Hamas in the 90s, the fact is that there were series of suicide bombings and Israeli counterattacks. I'm not saying there wasn't violence from both sides, but those suicide bombings that were carried out by Palestinians had a devastating effect on Israeli hopes. And each side's hope at the time of the signing at the White House were hopes against a background of great frustration, bitterness, and lack of trust. So that when these negative things began to happen, people didn't have to look far inside themselves to recall their negative views of the other side, their lack of trust of the other side, their lack of confidence that the other side really meant peace. Whereas Jews that I work with in the United States are very aware of how that happened among Israeli Jews and among themselves as American Jews who work very much for peace. They're not necessarily as aware as they need to be as how that happened among Palestinians. The same sort of deep loss of hope. And that's not helpful to any process. Where we are today is ambiguous. And we'll talk about that in the next couple of days. And the U.S. role is important. And obviously, Obama's commitment on this issue is important. But it's got some heavy water to get through. Yes?
Seems to have been there. I walked in later. But how much of what is the fear that everybody deals with, how much of that is actually between Israelis and Palestinians at, say, the person-to-person street level, mm-hmm. as opposed to what is generated by, say, governments and religious organizations and the press?
Well, no, it's both. I mean, it's both in the sense that, you know, the incidence of violence means that, for instance, whereas Jews during the positive moments of the Oslo process like to go to shop at Palestinian markets near Bethlehem, like to go into the old city to Palestinian markets in the old city, would stay away, frightened. And similarly, Palestinians, who have trouble always getting into Israel proper anyway, would not be very interested in, you know, making contacts with Israel. So no, I think it's visceral. I think it's visceral. I think this conflict is a conflict which has been a conflict of the people, not just of the government.
Okay. That's
yeah. Oh yeah. No, it's real deep.
Okay.
And but the other side of it is that and Oslo process years, the positive development showed that there is another potential there in both peoples. And that potential has rich possibilities. And I said this, I think, before most people came in. Next to Israeli Jews, Palestinians are the most highly educated proportionally in their population to any Arab country in the Arab world. And for the same reason. Because just like Jews who didn't have a country, parents encouraged their kids to get an education. I mean, that similarity is very interesting. And because they encourage them to get an education, Palestinian is a fairly highly educated society right now without the jobs that match the education level. But so there is another potential there, but the bitterness after the failure of the Oslo process took and is taking quite a serious toll. Quite a serious toll. I think we should stop. We're to be respectful of the time for that.
So would you repeat the name of the gentleman who wrote the process?
S-A-V-I-R. Savir is his last name. Uri is his first. U-R-I. Well, thank you.
Thank you. See you tomorrow.